on it.
Decker put the photo down on the table, face up.
What are your questions?
Said Gardner, glancing at the photo and then quickly looking away.
Well, and don't be offended by this, because we're asking everyone connected to this case. We need to know where you were when Susan Richards was last seen.
You can't possibly believe I had anything to do with her death.
Look, I don't want to believe that anyone is capable of murder. However, some people clearly are. But I'm not accusing you of anything. Just eliminating suspects right now. And we can do that with you if you can tell us where you were.
What time are we talking about?
Decker told her the day and the time in the evening. Gardner sat back and closed her eyes. Then she reached into her pocket and pulled out her phone. She brought up her calendar and ran through some screens. Then she seemed to breathe a sigh of relief.
I was at dinner with my husband, a business dinner. There were six other people with us. It's here in Trammell, at a restaurant, from 7 o'clock until well after midnight.
And your husband can verify that?
Said Lancaster.
Do you have to talk to him?
Gardner said worriedly.
He knows nothing about any of this, of my past life.
Well, if you give us the names of some of the other people there.
That's as good as telling him,
she snapped.
He's built up a great reputation in this area, and people trust him. Something like this could ruin him.
Well, can you think of someone else who can corroborate your whereabouts?
Asked Lancaster. Gardner suddenly looked animated.
Wait, I know the owner of the restaurant. She could verify it. We had a private room, and we paid with a credit card. You can check the receipt.
That works.
Lancaster pulled out a notebook and took this information down.
Is that all?
Asked Gardner, still clearly distracted.
You need to tell us where you were when your father was killed.
My father? Now you're accusing me of murdering my own father?
Again, I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm eliminating suspects, like we did for you just now with Susan Richards' death.
She looked at her calendar after Decker told her the time parameters.
I was home with my family. In fact, I was probably asleep at that hour, like most people,
she added.
And your husband can corroborate that?
If necessary,
she said between clenched teeth.
Is that all?
There's another discrepancy, said Decker. But I'm sure you can clear it up.
Gardner looked wearily at him.
I remember that you never seemed to stop asking questions all those years ago.
And I'm afraid I haven't changed. It just comes with the territory.
What discrepancy?
You said you'd never been in your father's closet.
Gardner seemed instantly on the defensive.
Who told you that?
Actually, you did, the first time I was here to question you.
Oh, okay. But I don't understand the discrepancy.
The police report indicates that you were the one to show the forensic techs the panel in the closet.
Gardner frowned.
I don't remember doing that.
It was in the report.
Then the report is wrong. It can be, can it?
Decker said,
So you're saying you didn't show them the panel?
I'm telling you, I don't remember doing that.
Okay, so they might have been searching and found it on their own.
I guess.
But why would they say that you told them about it?
Asked Lancaster. Gardner was very pale now.
I don't know. Maybe I did. I might have been helping them look or something. It's possible. It was a long time ago. And I was not in a good frame of mind. I didn't remember things very well.
Decker said,
Understood. Well, thanks for your time.
He stood. Lancaster quickly did as well, looking surprised that Decker was already done.
That's it?
Said Gardner, looking as surprised as Lancaster.
For now, yes.
Decker slid the photo of her as a child toward her.
I told you I didn't want it.
I know, but sometimes people change their minds, don't they?
Gardner made no move to pick up the photo.
Decker said, We'll find our own way out.
As they got into their car, Lancaster said,
Okay, I approve of your new subtle nature, Decker, but you really closed out the interview fast. I thought it was just getting good.
It was just getting good, but you can also push someone too far.
She's scared.
She is scared, because she knows more than she's telling us. She's very concerned that someone else will realize that, too.
Are you saying she might be in danger?
Everyone connected with this case might be in danger, including you and me.
We're cops. We signed up for that. Mitzi Gardner didn't.
Didn't she? Said Decker, as he put the car in drive. Chapter 49. Posh. That was the word that occurred to Mars as he pulled to a stop in the parking lot of the Silver Oak Grill. He didn't know what it used to be, but its old bones had been given new life. He looked around at the other cars parked there and saw a sprinkling of late-model expensive rides. There was even a Maserati convertible parked near the awninged entrance. He walked in and looked around. The build-out here had definitely been expensive. Mars had learned about construction costs from investing in real estate in the D.C. market. Old beams, pricey stone flooring, an elaborately carved bar, expensive wallpaper, coexisting with contemporary seating. The place was nearly full with folks having lunch, and there were three people ahead of Mars waiting to be seated.
Melvin?
He looked to his right and saw Rachel Katz waving to him from a table in the corner. He walked over and joined her. She stood and had to rise up on her toes to give him a hug and a peck on the cheek. Then she took a moment to appraise his attire. Gray jacket, black turtleneck, charcoal slacks, and black loafers.
Terrific outfit.
Thank you. You're looking quite sharp yourself, he said, noting her slacks, blouse, jacket, and flats.
Well, I came straight from work.
As they sat, he saw that she had nearly finished her cocktail.
Drink?
She said. He eyed the almost empty glass. What are you having?
Dewars and water. I'm ready for a refill.
Hitting the hard stuff in the afternoon, are we?
We are.
He grinned. Sounds good to me. They ordered their drinks and sat back.
When you called, I was surprised you wanted to see me again.
She said. Why is that?
Well, we left things a little, I don't know, flat.
I'm into long-range forecasting. Date-to-date doesn't mean much.
I'm flattered you referred to it as a date.
Their drinks arrived, and they tapped glasses. Katz took a sip and said,
And I guess I'm also surprised that Decker is letting you see me. I mean, he is investigating, and despite all the facts to the contrary, I guess I remain a person of interest, or something like that.
You know the lingo, he said, grinning.
I watch crime shows, what can I say?
Surprised you have the time, what with work and all your other projects. She leaned forward.
What would you say if I told you that most nights I go home, change into my PJs, eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with chips on top, and watch old movies?
He studied her. I would believe that, he quickly added. Not because you don't have options. I imagine you could have your pick of guys around here. She made a face.
Thing is, I don't want the guys around here.
Which raises the question of why you don't just move somewhere else. Chicago's not that far away.
David and I were thinking of moving there, and then he died.
So you feel tied to this place?
In a way, I guess. He's buried here. What he started to build is here.
Right.
You don't believe me,
she said, her mouth creasing into a frown. No, I do believe you. Look at Decker. He doesn't live here anymore, but he's still tied to the place. Comes back to visit his family's graves. Different people have different motivations. You want to stay here, you stay here. It's your decision, no one else's. She was about to say something, but then took a quick sip of her drink instead.
You want to order? The salmon is really good, but I'm going for the tuna tartare.
He glanced at the menu. How's the Wagyu?
It's great. We get it fresh every day.
We? She smiled.
I guess I didn't tell you I have an interest in this place, too.
A lady with lots of interests. Makes the world go round. They ordered, and Mars looked around the place before resettling his gaze on Katz. A lot of money in the parking lot and at these tables. Even saw a Maserati out there.
The Maserati belongs to that gentleman.
She pointed to a shortish man in his late 60s with thick gray hair. He wore a three-piece suit with no tie, crocodile skin loafers, and despite the chilly weather, no socks. At his table were six other people, four men and two women. Money man?
Yes, Duncan Marks.
Is he one of your partners?
No, not really. But he does a lot of projects around town, and we have done a couple deals together. But I'm a small fry compared to him.
Well, you're a big fry where I'm concerned. She smiled at his statement.
How's the investigation coming?
Decker's interviewing Mitzi right about now, checking alibis and stuff like that.
You mean for Susan Richards' murder?
Yeah, among other things.
Getting back to my earlier thought, how come Decker is letting you hang out with me? Is he hoping you'll learn some stuff so he can arrest me?
She said this last part in a cavalier way, but Mars could detect an undertone of apprehension. Like I said, I'm not law enforcement. I'm his friend. I don't tell him what to do, and he doesn't tell me.
But you still want to help him?
Sure I do. He spread his arms wide. And if there's anything you can tell me that will help, let me have it. She laughed.
You're an interesting man. There aren't that many around this town, at least that I can find.
You lost one when Decker moved away. That's a fact. Their food came a few minutes later. Mars tasted his steak and his eyes widened. Okay, that right there should be illegal. So damn good. I don't smoke, but I might just make an exception after eating this.
We were lucky to get our chef. He's from Indianapolis, trained under one of those master chefs you see on TV.
Well, the dude can cook.
Yes, he can. So, do you think Mitzi Hawkins will have an alibi for Susan's murder?
Asked Katz abruptly. Mars looked up from his plate. I don't know. Decker must have it by now, if she had one. Then he'll need to check it out.
Like he will mine.
That's right. He put down his fork and knife. You look concerned.
Are you waiting for my confession?
No, because while I don't know you well, you don't strike me as the murdering type. I have a pretty good nose for that, but still, there may be something else weighing on your mind.
No, I'm good. Just tired, I guess. Been burning the midnight oil lately.
She rubbed her temples.
After you left the club, I did a little business. It wasn't nearly as much fun as I had with you.
You flatter me.
Not to beat around the bush, Melvin, but I do find you very attractive.
Hey, you're beautiful, smart, ambitious, sensitive, the whole package.
Why do I sense a but coming?
I'm seeing someone right now.
Lucky girl.
I hope she thinks that, and I hope I didn't lead you on.
No, you made things pretty clear, actually. But a lady can always dream.
Mars sat forward. Look, Rachel, I like you, I really do, and while I'm not officially working with Decker, I am helping him any way I can, like I said. Katz leaned back and picked up her drink.
Okay.
The undeniable fact is that there are a lot of people dying around here. You had four people 13 years ago, including your husband. Then Merrill Hawkins. Then Sally Brimmer, although Decker was the target there. And then Susan Richards.
And your point?
If you know anything, anything at all, you need to tell us. Last thing I want is for something to happen to you. Katz's spine seemed to stiffen.
Thanks for your concern, Melvin, but I can take care of myself. And I don't know anything, so I have nothing to worry about.
Mars nodded slowly. Okay, if you're sure about that.
Very sure.
Because there's been another murder you might not have heard of. Katz had picked up her fork. She slowly put it down as she absorbed this news.
What? Who?
Man named Carl Stevens. He dealt drugs here. He sold stuff to Mitzi and to Frankie Richards. Decker thinks he might be involved.
And he's dead?
He was in prison. We went to see him. He said he knew nothing either. By the time we got back to Burlington, the man had a knife in his neck. Mars picked up his doers and took a sip. So apparently, some people don't care if folks know anything or not. They just kill him.
But how could... I mean, he was in prison. People get killed in prison all the time.
You're right about that. But the thing is, the tats that Stevens had on his arms...
What about them?
Katz said in a trembling voice. They matched the tats on the guy who shot Sally Brimmer. Decker was really sure about that. Nobody's memory beats his.
And you don't think that might be a coincidence?
Do you? Katz sat back and composed herself.
Well, I'm sorry about this Mr. Stevens, but that has nothing to do with me.
Okay, if you're sure.
I am sure.
Then let's just get back to this lovely meal. Mars finished all of his steak. Katz barely touched her food. She finished her second doers, though. As they were leaving, they passed Marks's table. Duncan Marks put out a hand and gripped Katz's arm.
Rachel, I thought that was you over there.
Hello, Duncan.
The place is doing fabulous. Another home run for you.
Thanks.
Marks looked at Mars.
And I don't believe I know your friend.
Mars put out a hand. Melvin Mars, nice to meet you, sir. They shook hands as the other people at the table stared dully at them.
Rachel said that was your Maserati out there. Beautiful car. Yes, it is. German engineering and Italian design. A match made in heaven.
They all laughed. They walked out of the restaurant and Katz turned to Mars. He said, seems like a nice guy.
Yeah. Look, I know we just had lunch, but can we have dinner tonight?
Okay, sure. Where?
She hesitated.
My place. I can't actually cook.
When he looked uncomfortable, she gripped his arm.
I promise it won't be like that. I just need to have a home-cooked meal and someone to talk to, and I'd like that someone to be you.
Mars squeezed her hand and nodded.
Sure. Sounds good.
7, okay?
I'll be there. Anything I can bring?
Just yourself, Melvin. That will be enough.
Chapter 50. Decker and Lancaster were sitting in the detective's room when the door opened. It was the M.E. He had taken off his white lab coat and was now dressed in a suit. He held up some paperwork.
Got some results for you, he said.
He joined them at Lancaster's desk and thumbed through the pages.
First up, Merrill Hawkins had some painkillers in his system. Oxycodone.
Would that have incapacitated him? Asked Decker. Could he have been unconscious when he was shot?
He could very well have been, replied the M.E. And Susan Richards. She died of an overdose of fentanyl. Doesn't take much with that drug. Nasty, powerful stuff.
Any sign during the post that she was a regular drug user?
No, nothing like that at all. She was in good shape, actually. Would have lived a lot longer.
And time of death? Asked Decker.
She'd been dead a while, Amos.
I asked you this before. Could she have been dead from the moment she allegedly left her house that night?
Well, I can tell you that her probable time of death would coincide with your theory. He paused. So you think she was murdered at her house?
Something like that.
The M.E. shook his head,
This case grows more complex by the minute. Glad it's not my job to figure it out.
After the ME left, Lancaster said,
Well, if you're right, then, someone killed her and took her body out in that suitcase and then dumped it. That means the person that Agatha Bates saw leaving that night was not Susan Richards.
Tall, lean, and blonde, said Decker.
Mitzi Gardner or Rachel Katz, like you said before. But I checked Mitzi's alibi for the time Richards was allegedly abducted. The restaurant verified that she was there all evening, long after Richards went missing.
So, Rachel Katz, then?
Speaking of, any word from your buddy on her?
He emailed. They finished lunch. Said Katz was acting weird. Wants to have dinner at her place tonight. He said he thinks she's going to open up to him. He also said he told her about Carl Stevens being killed, and though she tried to hide it, she got really freaked out.
Decker added,
Duncan Marks was also at the restaurant. Melvin talked to him, and Katz said he was involved with some of her projects.
I didn't know that. But you remember Marks, surely?
I actually did some work for him when his daughter, Jenny, got involved with a con artist. Marks came into Burlington way back and started buying up stuff. Took a little hit with the recession, but then came roaring back, acquiring properties on the cheap. He's made a lot of money. Had the biggest home in the area when I lived here.
Still does,
said Lancaster.
On that hill outside of town, it's like the guy is looking down on the rest of us.
Reminds me of another guy with a big house on the hill in Pennsylvania. But he was broke and wasn't looking down on anyone, actually.
Well, Marks isn't broke. He's got money coming out of every pore of his skin. I heard he actually made a lot of money before coming to Burlington, investments or some such. IPO's another crap I'll never understand and never make a dime off.
Why'd he pick Burlington? I never knew.
I heard that his father was from here, worked in the old shoe factory before moving away, I believe. Marks bought that and turned it into luxury condos.
That's also where Rachel Katz lives.
Lancaster snapped her fingers.
That's right.
So according to Melvin, Katz was freaked out by the news of Stevens' murder, and now she might want to talk to him, and he's having dinner with her tonight.
Hawkins wanted to talk to you, too, and he's dead now. And who knows, maybe the same for Susan Richards.
They looked at each other.
Maybe we need to keep an eye on your buddy tonight.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Chapter 51. When Rachel Katz opened the door, Mars filled the doorway of her condo. He was dressed in light gray slacks and an open-collared white shirt with a dark blue jacket over it. He had a bottle of red in one hand and a bouquet of flowers in the other. Katz was dressed casually in jeans and a long-sleeved shirt, and she was barefoot.
I feel overdressed, commented a smiling Mars as he walked in.
You look great. I just felt like a jeans and no shoes night.
She thanked him for the flowers and wine and gave him a kiss on the cheek.
You didn't have to do that,
she said as she got out a vase and filled it with water, then set the flowers in it after snipping off the ends of the stalks.
My mom taught me it was always polite and respectful to bring something.
Well, your mother taught you right. Do you see her much?
No, she and my father both passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He shrugged. It happens. You want me to get this wine going?
Yes, please. My doer seems ages ago. The opener's in that drawer.
He poured out two glasses and handed one to her as he sniffed the air.
Something smells good. What's for dinner?
Caprese to start. Chicken parm with my own secret sauce for the main and cannoli to finish. Call it my Italian extravaganza.
You did that after working all day?
I like to cook, but I admit the cannoli is store-bought.
Still, damn impressive. You need any help?
You did your job by opening the wine and bringing the flowers.
Guys always get cut slack.
You are a wise man, Mr. Mars.
They ate about a half hour later. After they were finished, Mars insisted on clearing and cleaning.
You cooked, now it's my turn, he said firmly. As she watched him collect the dishes, she stroked the stem of her wine glass and said,
I hope the woman you're seeing appreciates what she has.
I think she does, but in a relationship, you got to keep working it, from both sides.
David used to say the same thing.
Mars rinsed the plates, glasses, and utensils and put them in the dishwasher.
Sounds like you two had a great relationship.
We did, only it was cut short.
Mars finished up and joined her in the living area, sitting next to her on the couch. She drew her legs up under her, holding out her glass as he refreshed her wine.
Right, that was beyond tragic.
But at least I thought it was over. And now Decker is back opening the whole thing up because he's convinced Merrill Hawkins didn't do it. But if he didn't, who did?
Did your husband have any enemies?
No, nothing like that. I told Decker the same thing.
Maybe Don Richards had enemies, or your husband was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
That's what I thought had happened, but I also thought that Hawkins had committed the murders, and it was a robbery or a burglary. Things were taken.
That could have just been a cover.
She nodded slowly, but hardly seemed convinced of this. Mars said,
When you invited me here tonight, it seemed that you had something on your mind. You said you wanted to talk.
Kat set her glass down and looked over at him.
I'm afraid.
Of what?
Like you said at lunch, people are dying, Melvin. Hawkins, Susan Richards, that woman from the police department.
I know, Rachel. It is scary.
And someone murdered my husband, and everything from the past just seems to be coming back. It's like I'm being haunted by ghosts I thought were long buried.
She put a hand to her face and wiped at her suddenly teary eyes. He put an arm around her shoulders.
Let me tell you something. Not that long ago, I was in a world of trouble. I mean, bad, bad stuff.
Then Decker came along. And he got to the truth, and the man changed my life.
After 20 years of people believing that a lie was the truth, but not him, not Decker. He just keeps digging. Dude never stops.
Katz shivered a bit.
He sounds like a man to be reckoned with.
Oh, he is, and people have tried, and he just keeps rolling.
Does he understand that there can be different shades of truth?
He drew a bit away from her, watching the woman closely.
Such as?
I mean, there are times when you can tell the truth, but people may not see it as the truth, not the same way that the person telling it does, and sometimes people feel they have to do things for, you know, reasons that might seem...
Seem what?
Wrong, I guess. But not to the person having to do the things. They might think it's the only thing they can do.
Mars looked confused by all this.
You've lost me.
Look, never mind. I know I'm not making much sense.
Take your time. I've got nowhere to go.
She changed the subject.
So Decker really believes that Hawkins was innocent.
Mars looked at her for a long moment, clearly disappointed in the change in direction of the conversation.
Let's put it this way. Hawkins didn't try to kill Decker twice, because the man was already dead when those events occurred.
You mean someone doesn't want the truth to come out? They're trying to stop Decker, and they silenced Hawkins because he might know something?
That's the way we see it, yeah.
He paused.
So do you know something that could help us?
If I did, I would have told you. I would have told people 13 years ago.
But there are shades of truth. That's what you just said.
She moved slightly away from him, as though symbolically distancing herself from this conversation.
It's amazing what a few drinks will do to loosen someone up,
she said, tacking on a brief smile.
I'm just trying to get to the truth, Rachel. That's all.
But sometimes the truth doesn't set us free, does it? Sometimes it traps us.
Is the truth trapping you?
No, of course not. I was just speculating, talking off the top of my head.
He took her hand. I want to help you, Rachel.
But you work with Decker.
That shouldn't matter. I already told you I don't think you killed anybody.
But...
she said quickly, and then stopped. But what? She abruptly rose.
I'm really tired all of a sudden. I think I'm going to call it a night.
Marsh stared up at her, and then his expression changed. He leapt up and tackled her as one of the large glass windows shattered. They both fell heavily to the floor as the shot fired through the window hit its intended target. Chapter 52.
Son of a bitch, cried out Decker.
He and Lancaster leapt out of his car, which was parked down the street and across from Katz's building. They drew their guns and hunkered down next to the vehicle.
There,
said Lancaster, pointing to the opposite building.
The shot came from there. I saw the muzzle flash.
Call in reinforcements,
bellowed Decker as he punched in Mars's number. It rang and rang with no answer.
Shit.
Do you think the shooter's still there?
Said Lancaster, putting away her phone after making the call.
If we go to check on Mars and Katz.
Right. He'll pick us off.
He glanced at Lancaster.
It could be the same guy who killed Brimmer. You wait here for the cops to show. Keep trying to call Melvin.
He texted the number to her phone.
What are you going to do?
I'm going after the shooter.
Amos!
But he was already running down the street, keeping right next to the building where the shot came from, to make it difficult for whoever was in there to draw a bead on him. He reached the front entrance of the building and looked it over. Plywood on the lower windows. The place looked abandoned, but it had a perfect sight line into Katz's apartment from the upper floors. He raced up the steps to the front entrance and noted that the large double doors were chained shut. He heaved his bulk against them, but not even his size and strength could budge them. He hustled on down the street, turned left at the next intersection, and raced down it. He was listening at the same time for a car starting up, or footsteps running away. The night air was brisk, and the sky clear for once. He could hear nothing except his own breathing. He reached the next corner and peered down it. Nothing. No one and no car waiting to take the shooter away. He forced himself not to think about Mars's fate. He had said a simple prayer that his friend was okay, and if he wasn't, Decker was going to risk his life to avenge him. He raced over to the rear entrance, and that was where his luck turned. The door was open, and Decker well knew why. The shooter had entered this way. He eased the door open and stepped through. He knew he was a big target, and he squatted down to make himself less of one. He took stock of the situation. The shooter might have already fled out the door and either driven off or used his own 2 feet to get away. Only Decker had heard nothing that would indicate either had happened, and he doubted enough time had elapsed for the shooter to make his exit. That would leave the person still inside an empty building, probably with a long-range, high-powered rifle, while Decker only had his new pistol, which he had never once fired, and would not be that accurate over any meaningful distance. The shooter could nail him from a lot farther away than Decker could the shooter. He saw a bank of elevators, but knew there probably was no power turned on in the building. That left the stairs. He used his mag light to show the way, and reached the door to the stairwell. Like Lancaster, he'd seen the muzzle flash too, and downloaded the image in his head, counting up the floors. Sixth. He cautiously opened the door and made his way up, slowly. He might meet the shooter coming down, or the person could be up there waiting for him. He counted the floors, until he reached number 6, understanding that the shooter could have gone to a lower floor, let him pass by, and then made his escape out the rear. A moment later, he heard the sirens. Okay. The good guys were on their way, and an ambulance, too, depending on what had happened in Katz's apartment. He opened the door to the 6th floor and peered inside. He hesitated to use his maglite because it would just make him a target. There was enough light from the windows to allow his eyes to adjust rapidly. The floor plan was open, which was good and bad. It cut down on the places Decker would have to look, but it also allowed him no cover while he did so. He closed the door quietly behind him and skittered over to behind an old metal desk.
"Take your time, focus, and listen."
All he heard were the sirens coming closer. That could be drowning out any sound of movement up here. He redoubled his efforts to hear any noise the gunman might be making. His position had been chosen wisely. If the shooter wanted to escape, he would have to leave through the door Decker had come through. He decided to try to move the needle.
"Police! You're surrounded! Put down your weapon and come out into the open where we can see you. Hands over your head, fingers interlocked. Do it now!"
He fell silent and waited. The sirens outside had stopped. Any moment he expected to hear the front door being knocked open, followed by feet pounding into the building. All he had to do was hold his position.
"Come on, come on, show yourself."
If it was the same shooter, Decker didn't fancy getting into another hand-to-hand battle with the guy. If it was the same man, he probably outweighed him by well over 100 pounds. Yet he had grave doubts that he would win such an encounter. That's when he saw it. The red dot swooping over the space, looking for him. The guy had a laser scope. That gave him the advantage over Decker, at least in some respects. But as Decker watched the dot flit around, the dust in the abandoned building was doing something quite remarkable. It was gathering around the light beam emanating from the scope, as though someone had clapped chalk erasers around it. Decker quietly slid to his left, moving out into the open briefly before taking cover behind some crates. He peered over the top of the crates, but didn't see the red dot anywhere. He ducked back down as the shot came his way, smacking the wall behind him. The dot had apparently been on his head. He kept moving, keeping behind the limited cover until he had worked his way to the far side of the room. He lay on his side and peered around the leg of a desk. He could see the red beam again. This time, he followed the thing to its source. He lined up his shot. A large wooden box. He fired 5 times, 4 through the wood, and when those shots flushed the guy, he unloaded his 5th shot at the exposed flesh. He heard a grunt of pain. Okay, he'd hit the guy, but it wasn't over yet. He looked for more red dots, but saw none. He slid forward on his belly until he halved the distance between them. He heard footsteps coming up the stairs. He was sure the other guy could too. That might draw him out, make him desperate. It did. Only not in the way Decker was expecting. A blur came out of nowhere, leaping through the air and landing on top of him before he had a chance to fire. The pair rolled around on the floor, struggling for the upper hand. Decker collapsed on top of the guy, trying to use his far heavier weight to crush him. He felt something on his face and realized it was the other man's blood. Then a wedge of elbow slammed into the side of his face, stunning him. He gripped the man's chin with his hand and forced it back, trying to take the neck to a place necks were not designed to go. He had not accounted for the man's other hand, though. The fist hit him once and then twice, both pummeling shots. Decker's grip was broken, and he was forced to roll off the guy. He saw the flash of blade and put up an arm to protect himself. 2 shots rang out. He saw the man above him flinch once, and then a second time. He dropped the knife, and then he fell to the floor with a thud. Decker sat up to see Lancaster slowly lower her gun. Chapter 53. It was morgue time again. Decker still felt slightly queasy from his fight. He stared over at the body on the gurney.
"I'd be on this slab instead of him, but for Mary."
Decker had been tremendously relieved to learn that Mars was unharmed, though Rachel Katz had been shot and was still in surgery. He lifted the sheet to stare down at the man. The tats on his arms were nearly identical to the ones Carl Stevens had. Decker had had the prison take pictures of Stevens' tats for comparison, just to be sure. He looked at them more closely and was once more struck by the unusual variety of images inked there.
But they all had something in common. They were symbols of hate groups. He looked over them, starting with the right forearm and going over to the left arm. Decker knew many of these symbols from his work with the police and later with the FBI. The folks represented by these tats were not exactly law-abiding. The number 88, that was the numerical equivalent, the eighth letter of the alphabet being H, of Heil Hitler. Then the shamrock and the swastika, taken together, was often the mark of the Aryan Brotherhood. The blood-drop cross, which was the primary insignia of the KKK, and known by the acronym MIOAK, meaning mystic insignia of a Klansman. And the initials KI, which might refer to another hate group, though Decker didn't recognize them. Still, there were some Decker had had to Google, the Aryan Terror Brigade symbol, and Weissmacht, which was German for white power. The Sonnenrad, which was an ancient Indo-European sun wheel and had been co-opted by the Nazis, who had placed the swastika dead center. Then there were the SS bolts, another Nazi symbol, and the triangular Klan symbol, which looked like three triangles within a triangle, but upon closer inspection would show itself to be three letter Ks in the triangle facing inward. All in all, it was quite the smorgasbord of ink. Decker had no idea why the man had all this on him, but he had obviously been one seriously demented man. The guy looked tough, even in death. A man with no scruples about ending someone else's life. As Decker's eyes traveled over the body, he saw scars and old wounds and other indicia of a violent life. He thought about Mitzi Gardner. She'd had a rough life growing up, and then she'd turned it around. She'd once more become her father's little star, of sorts, like on the back of the photo he'd found in Hawkins's wallet. Her star had fallen. And then she had been reborn. Or had she? Decker glanced over at the wall of slide-out cabinets where the corpses were kept. He strode over to the last one on the left. He opened the door and slid the rack out. He lifted the sheet and looked down at the body of Merrill Hawkins. He reached down and lifted up the man's arm. The tattoo with the arrow piercing the star. Symbolic of what? Then it clicked. He phoned Lancaster. She was still at the office filling out forms. Hawkins told us the prison initiated his compassionate care release.
I know he did,
said Lancaster.
I think he was lying.
Why?
His daughter was his star. He drew stars on the back of his photo of her that he carried around. The latest tat he got was the arrow through the star. I think he ran into Carl Stevens, and Stevens told him the reason why his daughter framed him. And then Hawkins applied for a compassionate care release, got his tat, and got out of prison to come back here.
But he said the prison people came to him,
countered Lancaster.
I think when we check into that, we'll find out that's not how the system works. The inmate files for it, not the prison authorities.
Okay, but you believed that he suspected that his daughter helped set him up from the get-go, and he did nothing back then.
Okay, then he didn't know the real person. The people behind it, maybe he just thought she was stoned and it screwed up somehow. It could have been some of her drug addict friends looking to do a robbery, and he didn't want to implicate her. Then he found out the truth.
You mean you think he found that out from Stevens?
Decker said, that's right. And maybe Stevens knew somehow that Mitzi was now living high on the hog. At that point, Hawkins didn't care about his daughter. She'd cashed in big time by framing him. Before he died, he wanted his name cleared. He put an arrow through his little star, got out of prison, and came to us.
If his daughter knew that, she would be a prime suspect in killing him.
She didn't have an alibi for his murder, so we're going to have to dig deeper on that. He paused. Oh, and Mary?
Yeah?
Thanks for saving my butt tonight.
After Decker clicked off, he looked back down at Hawkins' shriveled body. The man had gone to prison for a crime he hadn't committed. Then he'd found out that he had been set up, and he wanted the truth to come out, as his last act before dying. Well, Decker was going to carry the ball forward now.
I'm sorry, Merrill. You deserved better, from me and everybody else.
He rolled Hawkins's remains back into the cabinet and closed the door. It was too late to see Mitzi Gardner now, but he had somewhere else he needed to go.
Chapter 54. He drove over to the spot where he'd nearly lost his life tonight, but he didn't go back into the abandoned building. He ventured inside Rachel Katz's condo building and took the elevator up after flashing his creds at the officer guarding the crime scene's perimeter. The forensic team was still processing the area. Decker nodded at Kelly Fairweather, who was doing a bloodstain pattern analysis by the couch. In another corner of the apartment, Natty was talking with a second tech. He saw Decker and quickly headed over.
"Boy, close call for you tonight," said Natty.
Decker nodded.
"Mary really saved my butt."
"And she nailed the bastard who killed Sally," said Natty with a grim smile.
"Any word on Rachel Katz?"
"Still in surgery. Last I heard, she's going to make it. Close, though. Bullet nearly hit an artery. Your friend saved her life."
"I know. Melman's over at the hospital now with her, probably adding another layer of protection.
Guy had a fancy sniper rifle with a sophisticated scope."
"That laser scope gave me a bit of an advantage."
"Yeah, well, the guy could have made that shot from triple the distance away and still nailed his target. Easy. Or so my firearms guy tells me."
"Any luck on identifying him?"
"We're running his prints through the system."
"He had pretty much the same tats as Carl Stevens had."
"Yeah, Mary texted me and told me. You think there's a connection, obviously."
"We talked to Stevens and he's dead. The shooter kills Sally and then tries to kill Katz. Yeah, I think we can definitely say there's a connection. But the tats may help us narrow this down to a gang. They look to be some oddball collection of neo-Nazis and Klansmen."
"Great combo," said Natty sarcastically. "But the thing is, Decker, would that sort of gang have been operating here 13 years ago? I mean, I don't remember anything like that going on in Burlington then."
"Neither do I, but keep in mind, they could be muscle brought in now by the folks who were doing all this crap 13 years ago."
"Right."
Decker eyed him.
"How did your lunch go with your wife?"
At first, Natty looked like he might erupt in anger, but when he focused on Decker's sincere expression, he said,
"It went okay."
"Did she know anything?"
"No, I don't think so. She might have suspected. But look, Decker, Sally and me, we never, you know, we were just friends. Okay, maybe more than friends."
He let out an exasperated breath.
"It's this damn job. It gets to you. I'm not trying to make excuses."
Decker thought of Lancaster and her marriage.
"The job gets to a lot of people, Natty."
"So what are we supposed to do? How do we handle it?"
"If I knew the answer to that, I'd be a consultant to cops. A rich one. But spending time with your wife is a good first step. You mind if I look around?"
"Help yourself. Just don't keep your observations to yourself."
Decker nodded and went exploring. He entered the bedroom and gazed around the space. He wasn't exactly sure what he was looking for. He doubted Katz would have left a box with the word secret engraved on it for him to find, revealing all. But Katz was an accountant with a precise turn of mind. She was organized, paid attention to the details. You just had to look around her home to tell that. So there might be something she had that she felt she needed to keep, if only for protection from someone. He went through all of her drawers and then did the same methodical examination of her closet. She had a lot of clothes and shoes, like Susan Richards, but even Decker could tell that the stuff Katz owned was far more expensive than the items in Richards's closet. He dug back in the very rear of the closet and went through boxes and bags, but came away a half hour later with nothing to show for his efforts. He went into the bathroom and searched. When he got to the medicine cabinet, he found that Rachel Katz was on prescription anti-anxiety medication. That was not unusual. Lots of people were on meds like these, but still, he wondered what exactly she was so anxious about.
Well, the fact that someone tried to kill her demonstrated that she was certainly right to be anxious.
He picked up her purse, which was on the nightstand. Inside were her wallet,
a set of keys, and a building security access card. He pocketed those items and walked back into the main area to find that Natty had left to go back to the police station. The forensic team was finishing up, and Kelly Fairweather was packing up her kit.
"Find anything of interest?" asked Decker.
"Just blood and the bullet. It went into the couch."
She held up a small plastic container with a lid on top. Decker took it and looked at the bullet, which was in pristine condition.
7.62,
observed Decker of the round's caliber. She nodded.
"Right. It's called the NATO round. Lots of military forces use it, including ours. If that had hit her in the head instead of the shoulder, she'd be in the morgue, not the hospital."
Decker looked at her strangely.
"You okay?"
she asked.
"I'll be okay once we solve this case."
He left and hit the street. He had another place left to check where Katz might have kept something of value. Her office. It was only a few blocks from her apartment, so Decker was just going to walk. When he got there, he found the door to the building locked. He took out the key card, held it over the card reader pad, and the door clicked open. He checked the lobby marquee for Katz's office number and rode the elevator up. He strode quickly down the hall to her office door. All the other offices he'd passed had standard metal doors. Katz's office had a far more expensive solid wood door with matching trim. Knowing how she liked things just so, he wasn't surprised. He tried several keys he had taken from her purse until one worked. He unlocked the door and went in. He decided to use his mag light instead of turning on the office lights. There was a front reception desk, then a short hall off to the left. Two offices were off this hall, and then a kitchen workroom with a door that opened back into the reception area. The security pad was hung on the wall next to this door, its light glowing green. He went back to the first office and opened the door. This was clearly Katz's office. It was larger than the other one, and outfitted with custom shelves, a seating area with plush chairs, and a handsome partner's desk. The shelves were lined with business memorabilia, photos of Katz with various city officials, and others he assumed were her business partners. There were also photos of what looked to be her various properties and commercial projects. In each photo, Katz was smiling broadly, looking triumphant and happy. And yet, as Decker peered more closely, it appeared to him that the looks were hollow, that an underlying melancholy was present in each image. Maybe that was just him imposing what he knew now onto the woman's photos, or maybe not. Then he noticed the power cord lying on top of the desk. It was for a laptop, but there was no computer there, and there hadn't been one at Katz's home either. He opened some file drawers, and his suspicions were heightened. Someone had done a very good job of searching the office without seeming to have done so. He closed the drawer and looked at the shelving system built into the wall. He recognized it, since Katz had an exact duplicate in her condo. But not exactly exact. He stepped closer and noted a panel set between two open shelves. This same type of panel had been in her condo as well, but there was a difference. The one in her condo had a knob on it. Decker had presumed that was because the panel was actually a door and there was storage behind it. He had found this actually to be the case because he had looked inside it, yet there was no knob on this panel. He stepped back and looked at the unit again. He took the template from his memory of the one in Katz's condo and laid it over what he was seeing now. The absence of the knob was the only difference. He strode forward and felt around the perimeter of the panel, probing with his fingers. Then he pressed down on the lower left-hand side of the wood, and the door popped open. Behind it was a space filled with documents and files. He pulled them out and set them on the desk. He was about to go over them when he stopped, rose, left the office, and walked into the kitchen area. On the wall was the security pad. Why had it been turned off? Decker hadn't done it. He didn't have the code. He had known of the possibility that Katz would have her own independent security system for her office. The exterior of the building had security. The front door to her office had been locked, but the security system had not been engaged. An oversight, or... the whooshing sound of something igniting and the resulting smell of smoke that reached him a few moments later definitively answered the question for Decker. Chapter 55. Okay, that's a problem. The reception area was on fire, which meant the only way out was blocked. Decker called 911 and reported the fire and calmly asked for the fire department to get there before he was burned to nothing. He peered around the edge of the hall to see the reception area filling up with smoke. Next, he looked to the ceiling. There were sprinkler heads mounted there. So why the hell weren't they going off? He coughed and fell back from the flames. Well, this told him that he'd been right. There was something here that someone didn't want discovered. They had searched the place, but out of an abundance of caution, they decided to then burn it down, and somehow had disengaged the sprinkler system. He retreated to Katz's office and looked desperately around. He was on the fifth floor, so breaking the window and going out that way was not going to cut it. He put all the items he'd found behind the panel in a cardboard box, ran into the workroom with it, grabbed bubble wrap off the shelf and taped it all around the box. He rushed back into Katz's office, ran to the window, and looked out to make sure no one was walking down below on the sidewalk. He picked up her chair, carried it over to the window, and pounded it against the glass until the window shattered and fell away. He used the chair to scrape the rest of the glass away. He looked down to make sure it was still clear and dropped the box. It fell to the sidewalk. He could hear the bubble wrap air pouches collectively pop when it hit the pavement. He hadn't been concerned about anything in the box shattering on impact. Paper didn't break, but it was very windy outside, and if the box had burst open, he would have been running around the city trying to find the contents. The problem was, his opening the window had let the wind, and with it, enormous amounts of oxygen into the space from the outside. He turned and saw the flames right at the door of the office. Okay, this was getting damn tight. He heard sirens and the screech of brakes from below and saw two fire engines pull up. He leaned out of the window and cried out, "The fire's coming into this space! I need to get out! Now!" The firemen signaled to him, and four of them rushed to one of the trucks and pulled out an inflatable jump cushion, which they quickly pumped up and positioned under the window. Decker looked down at it. From up here, it seemed about the size of a twin bed. "Shit!" "Jump!" yelled up one of the firemen. "I'm a big guy. Will that hold me? Or do you have a larger size?" Decker called back. "This will hold you, don't worry," the fireman yelled back. "Just jump away from the building, back to the ground. We'll reposition if need be." Reposition if need be. Well, that's comforting. He wondered when these guys had done their last refresher course on catching huge guys falling from great heights. He hoped it was this morning. Decker turned to look at the flames. "Do I take my chances there?" Suddenly, an explosion racked the office space and a gust of hot air blew embers over him. "Here goes nothing." He climbed up on the windowsill, looked down to make sure he was lined up as best he could be with the cushion, said a silent prayer, and jumped. He was looking up at the sky, which was better than looking at where he was going. Were they repositioning right now? Or were they freaking out because they'd totally screwed up? Was he about to slam into the pavement? Unsettling thoughts, but he needed something to pass the time because it felt like he was falling for about 5 miles instead of five floors. When he hit the cushion instead of the pavement, all the air was still knocked out of him. Hands grabbed at him and hoisted him quickly to his feet. "You okay?" asked one of the firemen. "I am now. Anybody else in there?" "Not in the office I was in now. I don't know about the rest of the building." "Any idea how it started?" "Yeah, which is why I'm calling in the arson squad." Decker showed the stunned fireman his creds. "Someone turned off the sprinkler system in the building," he said. Another fireman came up with the box Decker had dropped. "We found this on the street." Decker took the box from him. "Right where I dropped it. Thanks." As the men were fighting the fire, Decker sat on the opposite curb and called up Burlington's arson squad and filled them in. Then he called Lancaster and did the same.
"You jumped out of a building?"
she said. "Well, not by choice. It was either that or be quick fried. I wouldn't recommend either, actually."
What the hell is going on, Decker?
She said.
It feels like the whole town is under siege.
That's because I think it is.
I'm still filling out forms. I'm starting to regret shooting the guy.
I'm heading back with a box of stuff I collected from Katz's office. I'll meet you at the station.
Decker hefted the box and looked at the ladders and hoses and men combating the fire. He set off down the street, climbed into his car, and drove to the police station. Decker met Lancaster inside. He followed her into the same small conference room, set the box on the table, cut away the bubble wrap, and opened it. He handed Lancaster a stack of stuff and put another stack in front of himself.
Her laptop wasn't there. I think whoever searched her office took it. Or maybe she has it somewhere else. When she comes out of surgery and regains consciousness, we can ask her.
Lancaster looked at him doubtfully.
You think she's going to cooperate?
Considering somebody just tried to kill her, what choice does she have?
You might be surprised.
Well, life is just full of surprises. That's why we play the game.
He turned his attention to the stack in front of him. Financial documents, construction plans, Excel spreadsheets.
She had a lot of business going on,
commented Lancaster as she started going over her set of files.
Did you have any luck running down any of her backers?
Not really, but we did find out that there were shell companies for the most part with locations in countries where they believe transparency is a bad word.
I wonder why that